Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Newsmakers from America and around the world speak with journalists in an unscripted and unrehearsed discussion about the critical issues facing the United States and the world. Here is your host on this edition of Press Conference USA, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm Doug Bernard, sitting in for Carol Castiel. On this edition, we welcome Vikram Chandra. He's author of the just-published book Geek Sublime, The Beauty of Code, The Code of Beauty. It's published by Grey Wolf Press and is already earning high praise. So, recently, a colleague saw a copy of Geek Sublime on my desk. "Oh, cool," she said. "What's that about?" I sat silently for a bit, but that didn't mean that I wasn't thinking. It's just that all the words that came to mind, I edited, cut back, tried again, re-edited, struck through, my language just kept getting in the way. So that's when I said, well, I guess it's kind of a meditation on language, human and computer. I'm still not sure I got it. So allow me to quote London's Daily Telegraph newspaper. They called Geek Sublime, quote, part memoir, part analysis of geeks, part aesthetic treatise. I'm not sure they did much better. Vikram Chandra joins us from our VOA studios in New York City. Mr. Chandra, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So my first indication right up front that this book was going to be something different was actually right in the acknowledgments, where you have an extensive area thanking people for translations and instruction on Sanskrit texts and poems. So I'm just curious, was a book that mixes computer code and ancient Sanskrit poetry ever a hard sell?
Yes, yes, and it was a hard sell to my first reader as well, who's my wife, Melanie Abrams, who's also a fiction writer. You know, when I showed her the first draft, she said, well, this is all very interesting and various, but who's your reader and where are we going to publish this?
So, how did you answer that?
When I'm writing anything, even when I'm writing fiction, I tend not to think of where it's going to go. I guess I have an ideal reader in my head who will understand what I'm trying to do. So I just kept bringing in various drafts and then finally sent it off to my agent, Eric Simonoff, and he seemed to be excited about it. And it's been quite a surprise that the book's sort of gone out into the world and found its readers, as it were.
So you are a fiction writer, but you've also at various times been involved in computer coding, basically creating programs in these computer digital languages. How did you become so interested in coding?
I was actually at film school at Columbia University in New York and obviously desperately in need of cash. So I found a job at a small company doing medical transcription. And this was way back in the early 80s. And while I was there, they got their first personal computers for us to work on. And I just started developing, as some do, a kind of compulsive interest in computers, the machinery, and the software. And then when I was writing my first novel, I discovered that people were willing to pay me to do this work that I enjoyed already. Mm-hmm. So it worked out quite wonderfully in that programming computers and doing consulting work paid for my research and my travel. And after I published my first novel, I took a university job in teaching creative writing, but I found that the interest in computers never left me, and it's still here today. I still try and keep up with the industry.
I think somewhere in the book you describe the kind of writing in computer language that you did as almost kind of creating these, you know, idealized, perfect, tiny little worlds.
Right. That's what's so pleasing about writing code, is that you create little pieces of functionality and then you can instantly test them to see whether they work or not.
Right.
And if they don't work, then you work on them some more and then you get them to work. And then you assemble these small pieces into larger pieces of functionality until finally you have an entire working program. And so the excitement of constructing a working machine that you can then change is very compelling.
We'll get into the detail in a moment, but I'm just curious, if you could compare for us for a moment the process of writing fiction and the process of writing computer programs.
I think there's some similarities. So first, of course, that they're both iterative processes. You write some language and then you look at it and you decide, oh, this is ugly, it's not doing what I wanted to do, and so you throw it away and then you try again. So there's a lot of editing and re-editing that goes on. And then, like I said, you're taking small pieces of functionality. In the case of fiction, you know, you write sentences and paragraphs, and then mm-hmm. you try and layer that up to build an overall effect. Although I think what you're trying to do with computer code is very different from what you're trying to do with literary language. And the frustrating thing about literary language is that you never can be entirely sure that it's actually working. So even if your test readers, my first reader being my wife, when I show it to her, she might like it. But there's this sense that you always have that the final effect of your novel or your short story lie beyond you. I mean, your ideal reader might be born 200 years after you're dead, right? So you always have the sense of looking for something that you can't completely find, and always you have the sense of falling slightly short of the perfect phrase, the perfect paragraph, the perfect story.
Right. It feels like there are two pools that we need to dive into a little bit. The first is machine coding, and the other is, of all things, Sanskrit. So you discuss the difference between machine code, assembly code, and computer coding. Briefly, how are these different?
So in the earliest days, I'm talking about the 30s and 40s when people started building programmable computers, if you wanted to work with them, you actually had to understand what binary code was, what a logic gate was. And there was the difficulty that for each problem that you were trying to solve, you had to actually fiddle with the machinery, and essentially you were building a new computer each time.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happens then is that people start to get frustrated with this, and they start trying to build programmable computers that you can speak to in electronic pulses. And that, of course, works, but it's unsatisfactory because it's very hard for human eyes to decipher that stuff. So there's an attempt to build second layer of language, I suppose you could describe it as, which is assembly language, which is essentially machine code, the kind of zeros and ones that the computer understands, but with mnemonics added onto the surface. So there's been a constant layering of one language over another in an effort, finally, to be able to speak to computers in languages that are closer to human tongue, so most often English.
Right. So machine coding is actually the language that the computer itself speaks, and it's all ones and zeros. Assembly code is sort of the intermediary between ones and zeros and that third layer of language, which is what most of us are familiar with, which is the actual computer programming, whatever you're writing the program in.
Right, exactly.
So I'm dating myself here, but I actually began programming in BASIC using punch cards.
Those
IBM punch cards, and heaven help you if you drop them.
Right.
So how different is computer coding these days than, frankly, not all that long ago?
Well, it's much more abstract. So it's quite possible for me, for instance, to write fairly sophisticated programs without actually knowing anything about how the computer actually works on a mechanical level. So I'm so cushioned from the metal that I work with a series of metaphors. So I work with a formal language that sometimes is very much like English, and then I can manipulate elements which are all abstractions.
Mm-hmm.
And so it really is quite wonderful that we are now able to tell machines to do things by speaking in languages. They're formal languages, but they're more or less amenable to human intelligence, to human conception.
When I think of computer coding and the process of, say, nonfiction or fiction writing, to me they seem to have absolutely nothing to do with each other. And yet your book is suffused with people and examples talking about computer coding in terms of beauty, elegance. You quote one programmer, for example, Donald Knuth, as saying of someone else's computer coding, he called it, quote, plodding and excruciating with no wit whatsoever. That sounds like something I would read in the New York Review of Books. So what is it that constitutes wit in coding?
Knuth is actually a great computer scientist who pointed out to us in the early 80s that when a programmer writes code, she's not really writing it for the machine. The instructions that you're sending to the machine are almost incidental. And the machine really doesn't care about how pretty your code is. The trouble is that some other programmer, maybe 6 months from now or maybe 20 years from now, is going to have to come and look at your code and try to fix it or try to find a fault in it or try and extend it. And therefore, your code has to have the virtues of clarity, of expressiveness. And so when I read down a screen full of code, it sort of should tell me in an essayistic way a story of what it's trying to do. And therefore, programmers become very interested in these qualities. And ugly code is incomprehensible code, code that is very hard to decipher, in other words. I should also say that we're dealing with very, very large objects. So there was a 2008 distribution of the operating system Linux which comprised 200 million lines of code. So even the architecture has to express its intent. It has to come apart in a way that is easy to understand and then to change, because otherwise you end up with these massive messes, as they're called in the industry, big balls of mud, that actually are impossible to understand.
So just as there's good writing and bad writing, there's good coding and bad coding. I spend part of my time helping people learn how to write, and it can be a challenging process. And I've sometimes wondered if really good writing is just something that's perhaps almost innate. Like, a good writer is a good writer. You can teach someone to become a better writer, but I don't know that I've ever been able to teach someone how to be a really good writer if they didn't have it in them. Is it the same with coding?
I think so. I mean, I teach creative writing, and people ask me often, can creative writing be taught? And what I always say is, you can teach craft, but you can't teach talent. And there are certainly coders whose programs that I look at, whose source code I read, and I know it's far beyond anything that I can ever do. I mean, they speak to the machine with an assurance and a kind of depth of insight and understanding that is quite spectacular. And those people often within the community become very famous, not just because of the success of their programs or how many copies they sell, but because they're known as creative coders.
Here was a surprise, one of many in the book for me. The world's first computer program was actually written by a woman.
This is one of those histories that should be available and apparent to everyone, but kind of has been overwritten, which is the pioneering role of women throughout the history of computing. So to take just a couple of examples, the first computer program ever was written by Ada Lovelace, who was Ada Byron, Lord Byron, the poet's daughter. And she worked very closely with Charles Babbage, who was a pioneer in computing in the mid-19th century. And so together, they were working on a machine which he called the analytical engine. And they had worked out its working conceptually, but technology of the time was not accurate enough to actually build that machine. But nevertheless, she wrote an algorithm to calculate Bernoulli numbers, and that was the first algorithm designed for execution by a machine.
It wasn't lost on me that the daughter of a famous writer turned to become, in some ways, a notable or famous writer of a different sort.
Exactly. Again, their literature and two kinds of language are working as if in parallel or in tandem with each other.
Just one quick note also. As I understand it, you discussed Charles Babbage and his analytical engine. He designed it in 1849, but it was never built in his lifetime. In fact, it was never actually built until 2002. There is something of an almost literary sadness in that for me.
Yes, and you know, the idea that the man and Ada Lovelace were able to conceptualize this thing that is actually functional. It works. It's one of those interesting what-ifs of history. What if they had actually managed to get it working?
Right.
And there's actually a whole subgenre of science fiction, steampunk, which elaborates on that conceit.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our guest, Vikram Chandra. His latest book is Geek Sublime, The Beauty of Code, The Code of Beauty, published by Grey Wolf Press. Just this quick reminder, Press Conference USA is available online as a podcast, so you can listen to us anytime you want. Just visit our website, voanews.com, and click on podcasts. Also, we love hearing from you, so please do send us your comments and feedback. Especially interested in your thoughts on today's author and topic. You can send those comments to us at pcusa@voanews.com. Vikram Chandra, explain this term for us, brogramming.
With the increasing economic and political importance of Silicon Valley, various kinds of programmers have sort of entered the field over the generations. So as the historians of programming point out, we have that first couple of generations of people like Steve Wozniak working and establishing the computer revolution. And the general sort of affect there is of the geek, of what is affectionately known within the industry as the neckbeard, you know, your Unix administrator who lives in the basement and runs your systems. But with the success of people like Mark Zuckerberg and this idea that you can become a billionaire overnight, what we're seeing now is the influx of young men who are thinking of this as a very cool way to make very large stacks of cash.
Right.
And that has introduced a kind of new social model, which is the frat personality sort of transformed into a programmer within Silicon Valley, and therefore the programmer, a kind of aggressively male,
right,
very cool partying programmer, as it were.
You quote someone as using this phrase, in fact, in this sort of similar related topic. The phrase is a lord of the flies in a French kitchen, and it really is kind of, I think, trying to get at that image that has been cultivated that programmers are sort of swaggering cowboy, independent, loner types. You know, here's a stereotype. Usually male, usually white, usually perhaps maybe in the basement coding and in their mother's right. house. But you spend a lot of time taking a lot of that apart and saying, no, no, actually that's really much more artificial stereotype than reality.
Yes, and it's becoming increasingly clearer, especially if you start looking at these questions cross-culturally. So one of the interesting things that I describe in the book is that there's more of a proportion of programmers in India who are women than in the United States. And it's a strange paradox. And in the last survey, I think, which was done in 2012, of women's access to health and security and so forth, the rankings listed the United States as number 22, and India came in at a very dismal 105. And yet, we have 30% of programmers who are women, as opposed to the United States, 21.1%. So there's been a great deal of scholarly interest in this phenomenon. Anthropologists and sociologists and so forth have been looking at this. And what the academic research has shown is that starting with girls in middle school and high school, mm-hmm. there is the notion that the sciences and mathematics are not gendered as male activities. Women report feeling very at home. One of the surveys asked undergraduate engineering students if they felt isolated in their discipline. And only about 8% of the women said yes, whereas 18% of the men said yes. Hmm. And I think this shows the increasing influx of women into both the computer science discipline in academia in India and also in the industry. The conclusion that a lot of these scholars are coming to, and they're looking not just at India, but at countries as disparate as Mauritius and Iran, and they're arguing that the gendering of specific kinds of knowledge production is specific to certain cultures and certain societies. And I think within the United States, for a host of historical reasons, this kind of pioneering intellectual work has been very much made the realm of the intellectual cowboy, the pioneer. Right. Who's not using the axe and the rifle, but is using the microscope and the computer.
We've taken just a bit of a dip into one of the pools that you write about, coding language and kind of this geek culture. Starting in Chapter 5, which is titled The Code of Beauty, you take a fairly deep dive into something completely altogether different. At least that's how it seemed at first to me, which is linguistics and Sanskrit. In my mind, however, as I plowed through this, a parallel began to grow roughly to machine code, assembly code, and computer code that you discussed earlier, using Sanskrit as another manifestation or example of this.
Right. And there is actually, strangely enough, very direct connection between Sanskrit and modern programming. Sanskrit is the oldest Indian language for which we have texts going back some 4,000 years. But in 500 BCE, a man named Parnini wrote a very short grammar for the Sanskrit language. And the interesting thing about this text is that although we call it a grammar, it's not a paradigmatic grammar in the same way that you and I might have encountered in second grade, where they show you declensions of a verb in, you know, 16 of them, and you have to learn them by heart, and that's how you learn a language.
Mm-hmm.
Parnini's grammar is actually 3,976 rules which act on sounds and phonemes. Any modern programmer would recognize it as a rule set. And so what happens is when you require a word in a certain case and in a certain first person or second person, you take one of the verbal roots that is given to you and you put it through the system of rules, and one rule sets off another, mm-hmm. and at each point, the sound gets changed a little until out pops at the other end a complete word ready for use.
Almost like an analytic engine, a computer engine.
Exactly. It's a very sophisticated algorithm that produces Sanskrit words and sentences, and an infinity of them. Ashtadhyayi, eight chapters as it's called, has a very interesting career both within India and outside India. It gets discovered by the West in the 18th century, and the Germans first translated it, and then over the 19th century, it becomes very, very influential in the modern linguistic discipline.
Mm-hmm.
And we can see this particularly in specific people. So Ferdinand de Saussure, for instance, who we regard as the father of structural linguistics, people might not know that he was a Sanskrit professor. Leonard Bloomfield, who set the direction of American linguistics in the 20th century, was also a Sanskrit professor. Noam Chomsky often talks about his debt to Panini in terms of the generative grammars that he came up with. So when people are looking in the 50s, programmers are looking to try and find a way out of machine code and even assembly code and trying to construct artificial formal languages, they go to modern linguistic science. And what they find there is these Panini-influenced ideas of how you can use language to describe itself. And so the form that is now most commonly used to describe computer languages is called the Backus-Knorr form. And that looks very much exactly like the Paninian form of describing language.
Yours, by the way, I think is the only book I've ever read that references Ferdinand de Saussure and Chad the Programmer.
Yes, and they're connected. You see how?
Actually, in reading the book, I actually did begin to see how what seemed to be two very disparate and perhaps even arcane areas of study and knowledge had this kind of remarkable overlap. Which for you was more difficult or challenging and also more rewarding? Diving deep into the structure of logic gates and, you know, computer engine, or diving deep into the linguistic structure of Sanskrit and human language?
Well, I think both were equally difficult, in that what I wanted to do was to have a sort of two-way door. And so one of the first impulses I had to write what I first thought was going to be an essay was to write a kind of ethnography of programming for civilians, for people who were not in the IT industry. Because we live in a world which has been profoundly transformed by these technologies, but most of us know nothing about the personalities or the technologies that are actually used. So for people like my wife, who's a fiction writer, I wanted to convey to her some of the excitement of what goes on inside the world of programming. I think conversely, we treat programming as a kind of magic, and there's also a sense in which the same kind of conversation goes on about writers. What do writers do? Well, they create ineffable beauty through language.
Right.
Well, how do they do it? Well, you know, it's ineffable. We can't talk about it. So I also wanted to try and understand the working or the functioning of poetic language for people who are not writers, and specifically programmers, because programmers have this tendency to describe themselves nowadays as artists. And so I wanted to talk to them about what is it that people who work with literary language actually do. It's different, but I wanted to show exactly how.
At various points in the book, you describe your own process trying to understand this, as you say, this sort of ineffable thing. Chapter 9, which is titled The Language of Literature, you begin with, I think, one of those examples of this questioning that you yourself, as both an author and a programmer, go through. I wonder if you could read a little bit of that for us.
Sure. Sometimes the sheer vastness of what I want to put into fiction terrifies me. I survive by not thinking about the whole. I write my 400 words this day, and then another 400 words the next. I find my way by feeling, by intuition, by the sounds of the words, by the characters' passions, by trekking on to the next day, the next horizon, and then the next. I pay attention to the tracks of narratives I leave behind, and I look for openings ahead. I make shapes and I find shapes. I retrace my steps, go over draft after draft, trying to find something. I'm not sure what until I begin to see it. I am trying to make an object, a model, a receptacle. What I am making will not be complete until I let go of it.
You'd say at the beginning there that this is what you do when you're writing fiction. But when I read that, I thought to myself, this might equally apply to someone who's genuinely trying to create beautiful computer code.
Right. Although the difference, I think, is that generally in computer code, you know the problem that you're trying to solve, right? So, you know, you get an idea for an app, say, that has functionality X, Y, and Z, and then you break it down into smaller and smaller pieces. And that's, for me, the very pleasing thing about writing code, is that after a morning of groping around in this literary haze, I look forward to the pleasure of programming because I know exactly what I'm going to do with my pieces of code.
Mm-hmm.
The trouble with writing fiction is that often you don't even know what problem you're trying to solve. In other words, I always start books with a very vague idea of a character and a location, and I have no idea what the story is. But the only way I can figure out what the story is to start writing and follow this character. So you often feel, when you're creating fiction, that you're waiting for things to come to you, and you can't force it, and your process is what reveals your intention. Which is why I think artists and writers are a little bit nutty. You know? I think the stereotype is actually true, because you spend your life in this state of anticipation and then sometimes frustration when it doesn't actually work.
So in close, how far off the mark was I when I described this as a meditation on language? And you can be honest and tell me way far off the mark.
No, that's what it absolutely is. It's a meditation on language. And language in its various aspects, in its various incarnations. There's a very famous Indologist named Fritz Stahl, who once made, I think, the quite perceptive observation that the Greeks keep returning to the insight that the world is mathematics. And he said the Indians keep returning to the insight that the world is language. And I suppose this is my kind of Indian exploration of this idea of various aspects of our world as being constituted by language.
Vikram Chandra, author of the book Geek Sublime, The Beauty of Code, The Code of Beauty. Thanks so much for spending some time with us. This has been a real delight.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Press Conference USA on The Voice of America was produced in Washington. Our engineer is Pete Hundley. Anya Zalewski produces our program. I'm Doug Bernard, sitting in for Carol Castiel. Hope you'll join us again next week on Press Conference USA.
Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. From Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, The Voice of America has brought you Press Conference USA. You can email your questions or comments about this edition of Press Conference USA to pcusa@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune to The Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us again next week when another newsmaker speaks with journalists about the critical issues facing the United States and the world. We'll see you next week for another edition of Press Conference USA on The Voice of America.